From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The U.S. Senate is one step closer to completing one of the fastest Supreme Court confirmation in the court's history. Today, Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to send Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the full Senate, and they did so without a single Democrat in the room. Here's Senate Judiciary Chairman Lindsey Graham.
Today, I want to celebrate the fact that Judge Amy Barrett will be reported out of this committee unanimously, that to all the young women out there like Amy Barrett, this is a big day for you. To the country as a whole, you're going to have an associate justice on the court that you should be proud of.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now. And Claudia, this was not the hearing that most people were expecting today. The Democrats, on relatively short notice, said they were boycotting the vote and they didn't show up. Have you ever seen a committee vote like this before?
Not quite. This is all unprecedented, especially coming off a week where we saw hours and hours of testimony. Barrett was questioned for about 20 hours last week. In addition, there were other witnesses. And today was wrapped up. That vote was wrapped up in about 12 minutes. So, yes, this is pretty unprecedented. And again, we're in the midst of a pandemic. This is being rushed. This is about 30 days from the day President Trump nominated her to when she could be confirmed. Voters are heading to the ballot box already. We have an election underway, and there's a lot at stake that Democrats are highlighting, such as health care. And of course, we have this bitter partisanship on display. So it's pretty contentious, but it's also a culmination of fights over a series of nominations to the Supreme Court that started from President Obama to President Trump today.
Well, also contentious today because Lindsey Graham pushed the vote through despite rules that Democrats say required at least two members of the minority party to be president. How did Lindsey Graham justify that?
He said just because Democrats decided to boycott the hearing today, that didn't mean the committee would deprive Amy Coney Barrett of that vote to send her nomination forward to the full Senate. So they were able to dig deeper into the rule book, if you will, and find one arcane provision that allows the committee to transact business if a majority of senators of the panel are present. This rule has been used at least seven times previously, also under Democratic control of the committee. So, of course, today we had the panel's majority there, the 12 Republicans, versus the 10 Democrats who no-showed, and they were able to move forward with this vote.
Well, Democrats filled their empty seats with poster-sized photos of Americans who rely on the Affordable Care Act, which Democrats say will be struck down if Barrett is confirmed. And then after this morning's vote, they held a press conference on the steps of the Capitol. Here's Minority Leader Chuck Schumer calling the vote a sham.
We are voting with our feet, and we are standing against this unprecedented mad rush to jam through a Supreme Court nomination just days before an election.
And you can hear some protesters in the background there. Capitol Police say there were actually some arrests as well. But what do you make of the Democrats' strategy here? They really don't have a lot of cards to play.
They really don't. In terms of this nomination forward, this is not going to stop it. But for Democrats, this was more sending a final message to voters during this final stage of the hearing process. And that's that Barrett will shift the court to a 6-3 conservative majority. And they wanted to make clear this is an illegitimate process and what's at stake. Some outside groups were pressuring Democrats to boycott the hearings entirely even last week, but they declined and they took part in her questioning. But today, they took that opportunity to no-show, and instead, they had that press conference, and they're delivering this message again that health care, reproductive, and voter rights are some of the things that are at stake right now.
Well, and briefly, we're seeing that new polling suggests that opposition for Barrett's confirmation is not as strong among some Democratic voters as it once was. Does that signal to you that Democrats failed to get their message through during these hearings?
If Democrats are worried, I'm not hearing that among them. They think that public opinion is on their side. They're very bullish with their stance. They think their message is resonating with voters, that Barrett is being rushed through by a Republican-controlled Senate and putting some key concerns at stake. So it's not that Democrats decided to boycott and say that in their argument that it wouldn't have an impact. They think it will have an ultimate impact in their case.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what to make of that hastily scheduled news conference last night called by the directors of National Intelligence and the FBI to say that Russia and Iran had obtained some American voter registration data, and Iran was behind those emails that said that came from the far-right group, the Proud Boys, and threatened voters if they didn't support President Trump. National Intelligence Director John Ratcliffe said the emails were intended to undermine President Trump, which raised questions, and as did the fact that there was nothing said about Russia. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper joins us on his phone. And Director Clapper, so people were getting these emails purporting to be from the far-right group, the Proud Boys, who've said they feel that President Trump supports them. Those emails threaten people if they didn't vote for Trump. Director Ratcliffe says that was undermining Trump. Your thoughts?
Well, first, a general comment that it's too bad that when an announcement like that is made by the director of national intelligence and the director of the FBI, that we simply can't accept what they say at face value. And instead, we spend time, like you and I are now, parsing and analyzing what was said and what wasn't said. As to the specifics, it's the Russians, have been busy with obtaining information about voter registration rolls for some time. They did that in 2016. So that was not a startling revelation. The DNI mentioned Russia, and that's all. There was no additional detail. And then went on to talk about Iran and these purported alleged emails generated by Iranians. May all well be true, but it serves to underplay what is the most profound threat to our election apparatus and election process, which continues to be Russia. And since his boss, the president, doesn't like to hear discussion of Russia as a threat to our elections, I surmise that's why it wasn't mentioned. Moreover, in previous pronouncements, the administration has played up China as a primary threat, which wasn't even mentioned. The timing is curious, coming on the heels of a scathing indictment by President Obama of President Trump. And, of course, I don't understand quite the rationale, given how brief the announcement was, no context or supporting evidence. I don't understand the rationale for why this hurts President Trump, since this constituted, apparently in the emails, threats to Democrats for not voting for President Trump. I will say, Director Ray, who's a man of integrity, a straight shooter, a truth-to-power guy, whom I would liken as the Dr. Fauci of law enforcement and intelligence, he's credible and should be believed.
Well, you say he should be believed, but you know that there's concern that President Trump wants to fire FBI Director Christopher Wray because he has not launched an investigation of Joe Biden, as President Trump has been calling on him and William Barr to do, because of those emails that surfaced that purported to be between Joe Biden and his son and purported to show corruption when then Vice President Biden was working in Ukraine. Again, these emails have not been verified. They were supplied by Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, who has had contact with Russian operatives. What are you thinking when you hear this notion that Trump might want to fire him and is certainly outraged at him?
Well, I think there's probably been discomfiture with Director Wray for some time, and there's long been speculation about his tenure. And as for the mysterious laptop that was dropped off at a repair shop in Delaware last December and suddenly appearing and then reported in the New York Post, there are several curious aspects about this as well. And, of course, for me, it needs to be seriously considered as a part of the Russian information operations campaign, although the DNI was quick to dismiss that. I'm not so sure.
Well, again, just to back up what you just said, Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe, a former Republican congressman and a strong President Trump supporter, did come out and say he felt there was no connection to the Russians, and that laptop. Sounds like you have questions and might have looked into that a little more.
Well, you balance that against the interesting statement made, and I guess it was in a letter by the FBI and would simply said we had nothing further to add to what the DNI said. Well, that could be interpreted a number of ways. And as far as I understand, as far as I know, the FBI has in possession of, if not the laptop itself, certainly a replica image of its hard drive. So presumably they are still sorting out forensically the provenance of that laptop.
James Clapper, former Director of National Intelligence, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks for having me.
We wanted to take a minute today to take a look at another time in history and ask ourselves, can we rise to the occasion now the way Teddy Roosevelt did then? That's the question author David Gessner poses. Roosevelt saved more than 200 million acres of land in national parks and monuments, national forests. David followed Roosevelt's trail, camping in the South Dakota Badlands or Arizona's Grand Canyon or California's Yosemite. As he asks himself, can we continue to do what Roosevelt did and save old and new sites? President Obama designated Bear's Ears in Utah a national monument, and then President Trump reduced that monument by 85%. As for David Gessner, while he's on a roll, he asks, can we now save the Earth from climate change? Thinking of Roosevelt, he says, what must it be like to save something? In 1903, when then-President Theodore Roosevelt visited the Grand Canyon, he said, leave it as it is. You cannot improve upon it. Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness, is David Gessner's new book. And David, I think the last time you were here, we were talking about a successful effort to save ospreys in New England. So welcome back.
Thank you. It's a little easier to save ospreys and save the world, but same kind of basic game plan.
Well, and your book is literally a journey. It's a road trip that you took with a nephew. And what were you looking for?
Well, you know, I'd had a lot of friends who were writers who were kind of knee-jerk responding to whatever Donald Trump had done. And when he undeclared, or rather Ryan Zinke, his Secretary of Interior, standing in front of a picture of Teddy Roosevelt on what would have been Roosevelt's 159th birthday, undeclared Bear's Ears National Monument, or 85% of it, I was upset enough to think, I'm going to reply to this, but I'm going to do it the slow way. And I'm going to write about public land and why it's still important to save it and why it could be kind of the Noah's Ark for our future. And that what Roosevelt did back then was prescient. And we need to have that same kind of vision now.
And I just want you to explain that, why it might be a Noah's Ark. It might be, in many ways, by being smart about public land now, there may be a way to give species a path out of the United States, for instance, elsewhere. It may be the thing that can allow endangered species to travel to areas where they can live.
Right. When Roosevelt started declaring national monuments in 1906, he was doing something big and bold and unheard of. And right now we have bold ideas going on in the West. You know, we have fires going on in the West, of course, but we also have bold ideas. And the one that you're describing is Y2Y, Yellowstone to the Yukon. And what has happened is we've started to connect parks. So there are pathways with vegetated underpasses and overpasses. And that allows for migration to happen and the big carnivores to start to move and migrate like they want to, and for evolution to keep evolving. So despite the depressing, you know, daily news about the fires, what we have is this idea of bold, big parks that can save us, that can save animals.
Hmm. Look, let's just take a second and remind people who Teddy Roosevelt is. Many already have an image in their mind. And as you say, sometimes it's a caricature, you know. Yes, FDR's Republican cousin several years before FDR, sick as a child, as a man, I love this phrase, a nonstop self-mythologizing machine, you know, itching for either a fight or a good hunt, created his own regiment to participate in, you know, the war in Cuba, led his men up San Juan Hill. You know, kind of somebody that you ordinarily might not be attracted to, somebody who's just, you know, America first, manifest exactly. destiny. Yeah. But then there's the other one that I think you say, as others do, you, like other people, fell a little in love with, you know, the one who loved birds.
Exactly. Well, you know, he's got a lot of Trumpian characteristics. His daughter Alice said of him, "My father always wanted to be the corpse at every funeral, the bride at every wedding, the baby at every christening." And, you know, grew up rich in New York. He actually had two small hands. They always made fun of him for that. But their differences really define them. And one of the big differences was not only did Roosevelt grow to, like, read a book a day at one point. He was so curious and intensely curious. But he studied. His dream when he was a teenager was not to be a soldier, not to be a president. It was to be a working naturalist like his hero, Charles Darwin. And it was through birds and the study of birds that he started to write. And eventually, he wrote 47 books. So this is the contradictory, kind of fascinating, hypocritical, bizarre Roosevelt, who I really did come to love. And so it's been an interesting summer with his statues going down, you know, with Trump saying Yosemite and Yosemite. You know, it's been this crazy time. But I think he's really a good case study for canceling, too.
You mean cancel, culture cancel.
Yeah, exactly. And I do in the book, I say, look, when it comes to his attitude toward Native Americans, there's no real forgiving him. So I won't try to forgive him.
Well, because as you write, many people of his day, and this is the late 1800s, you know, early 1900s, of course, there was genocide of Native Americans, forced marches. They were taken off these lands that were made public parks. That was their land in many cases. And he, like many, thought of Native Americans as maybe they could become like white people. You know, maybe they had a chance to become like white people. This was racism.
Exactly, it is. And, you know, you got to call it out for that. But it's part of the whole complicated picture of Roosevelt. I say, if we're going to give him credit for being ahead of his time in terms of environmental thinking, we have to call him out for being behind his times. Because it wasn't just he was of his times. He still believed in manifest destiny, which was a half century old at that point. So, we, you know, really what it came down to is he did have an America first border he shared with Donald Trump. And Indians, as he called them, were in the way. And I say Roosevelt had prejudices of his time, but he didn't have one major prejudice, which is anthropocentrism. He was able to see beyond man. He saw the world, and the world was worth saving.
Well, in that way, he was, I mean, that's part of how he earned the title traitor to his class.
Exactly.
And he did, as you know, he became a progressive. In fact, some say some of the things he did, you know, battling trusts and corporations, kind of paved the way for his cousin, FDR, and the New Deal. He invited a black man, Booker T. Washington, to the White House, castigated for that. His views on race were growing, but meanwhile, he was steadfast on the land. Mm-hmm. And you end up on Bear's Ears when there is some hope, because the move to preserve this gorgeous area in southeast, I think, Utah, with the two, what are those called, steps, STEPPES, that are the ears?
Yeah,
what are the ears?
They're buttes also.
Buttes? Okay, buttes. Yeah. The two buttes that just look just like bear's ears and just a gorgeous area had been, still is a very spiritual, sacred place for Native Americans. And Native Americans spearheaded the drive to make it into a monument. And you there's a whiff of hope there, you know, like that's maybe making up for some of the past. And then it gets rolled back by the Trump administration and Ryan Zinke. So what do you take from that? All this hope that was there, it's dashed.
Well, it's still there. It's going to depend a little bit about what happens in the first week of November. It also depends on what's happening in the District of Columbia Court, where the Antiquities Act is, you know, the central question which is being decided. And that question is, can a current president undo something a past president has done? So that's a huge question, because if it is decided that they can, it's almost bigger than any decision the courts will face, then nothing is permanently saved. So the exciting thing about Bear's Ears was, first of all, in the past, we'd often taken Native land away to create public land. Here, Native people were creating land that would be, you know, their land. It was also much more inclusive. and kind of a bigger non-touristy vision of how a park would be used. It would be used for ceremony, for gathering of plants. So it really excited me because it seemed a confluence of an old ideal, the Rooseveltian ideal, but here we were making America's best idea better. We were using these new ideas for the Antiquities Act. When we talk about the election, understandably, we focus on a lot of other things, but the land, climate change, these issues are not getting enough of an airing. These are, I would argue, more important than the issues that we focus on day to day.
David Gessner, just really, really briefly, just can you describe what it's like to sleep out in the absolute pitch black in a national park or monument with just the stars and maybe, a coyote or something passing by?
One was this recent trip where I brought my 21-year-old nephew out west for the first time, kind of reliving my own time out west, the first time I went after college. And we woke up and we had buffalo grazing near our tent. And
that's right.
He was impressed by that.
Snuffling other, and...
Yeah. I'm exiled in North Carolina at the moment, but every summer I head out west and I head to the mountains.
David Gessner's book is Leave It As It Is, What Roosevelt Said About the Grand Canyon, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. We'll have an excerpt at herenow.org. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Some good news, bad news from the U.S. Labor Department today. For the first time since March, unemployment claims fell below 800,000 last week. It's the lowest number since the pandemic first triggered massive layoffs this spring. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, is here with us now. And Ali, the number of people who filed jobless claims dropped by 55,000 from the previous week, which is good news, but really only in relative terms.
Yeah, and this is where it starts to get complicated, because the decline doesn't necessarily mean jobs are coming back. It means that some people are no longer claiming benefits because they've dropped out of the labor force. 78,000 men, and listen to this, 617,000 women left the workforce in September.
Wow.
So that's one problem, like leaving the workforce because you do something where you just don't foresee a job coming up anytime soon. So you're not actively looking for work at that point. The other reason is that people are transitioning to what's called the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation. It was created to bridge the gap after workers max out 26 weeks or half a year of state benefits. In the last recession, we extended those state benefits another half a year. We haven't done that. We've got this Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation. So the recipients from that program increased up more than half a million from the week before. So it's just people shifting around. It doesn't mean they're going back to work.
Can we take a closer look at what you just said about women dropping out of the workforce? This is very important. Now, it seems to me from what we've seen from past reporting is that these women are dropping out because there's kids at home. You know, they have to take care of the kids who are, you know, trying to get on their Zoom call for school, that sort of thing. Tell me more about that.
So there are a few things. You know, the last recession was mostly what we called a man session. The jobs that were lost were mainly held by men. In this particular instance, you've got women as primary caregivers, either to their children or someone else in the house. You've got professions that have been hard hit by this that are occupied mainly by women, including in education and the airline industry. So this is the opposite of the man session. Some people call this a she session. This one is really hitting women particularly hard.
Well, all of this reminds us of the importance of this pandemic relief bill that appears to be languishing in Congress. Where are we on the off-again, on-again negotiations there?
Well, it depends what hour you ask me. At the moment, we've got Nancy Pelosi saying that things look a little bit better than they did yesterday. So, you know, the main reaction we get from this is the market, which is sort of treading water right now because they are investors are anticipating a deal. It could go either way. At the moment, it does look like Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi are working on something together. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said if the White House and Democrats can come to some sort of agreement, he will support it. So it's anybody's guess at the moment, but it is really, really important that it get done.
Yeah. And Ali, real quick, in line with the economic pain that we've been talking about, ExxonMobil announced this week that layoffs are coming.
Yeah, you know, you and I have been talking about this for a few months, right? The oil market completely tanked on the news of COVID. And until, you know, with the idea that there's a second round of COVID coming, that, you know, countries are getting reinfected as winter comes along, demand is just not coming back for oil, particularly for jet fuel. It's starting to come back, but oil prices are still down. Demand's down 13% from a year ago.
All right. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
More than 220,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the U.S., and each person has a name and a story. So we're going to bring you one now from Kentucky. Denise Price is a mental health counselor who lives in Louisville. She and several of her family members contracted COVID-19 in August and have since recovered. But her 90-year-old father, Everett Pike, unfortunately did not survive. He passed away last month. Denise, welcome to you. I know your wound is still very fresh, so thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Peter.
And I know that asking a daughter to talk about her dad in this way can be a daunting thing. How do you sum up a life, right? But could you tell me about your dad a little bit?
Yes. My dad was 90. He had been to the doctor in February, and his doctor had told him that he would probably outlive him, the doctor, that he could be the poster boy for senior citizens, that he had, at 90 years of age, he had the health of a healthy 50-year-old man. So my dad was very active. He went to church 4 times a week. He had a lot of male friends. He belonged to 2 beagle clubs and still raised beagles. We live on a farm. 3 of my brothers live on this farm. It's about 80 acres with my parents. They're just a minute in walking distance. But my dad still had some livestock and tended to that every day. He was in good health until COVID hit us.
Well, and it's amazing how active Everett was. You say he rode a stationary bike 5 miles and cut 5 acres of grass on the day that he went to the hospital. What happened?
Well, there were 6 of us that had COVID, and we all had very similar symptoms. Just a very low-grade fever. And in fact, our fevers were so low, enough to make you uncomfortable. But several of us thought we just had sinus infections or something because it was such a low-grade fever. And my dad's symptoms were exactly the same. But my brother, who lives on the property, was faithfully taking my dad's temperature and taking his oxygen saturations with the meter we had. And on the day that my dad had already been on his bike, had already cut the grass, he came in and my brother took his oxygen saturations and they had dropped to 88, which if they ever drop below 90, it's a serious concern and you should get medical help. It took us about an hour to persuade him, coerce him into going to the hospital. He said, I know how this ends. I'll never be back again. The other thing that I didn't mention, Peter, about my dad is that he's a retired police officer. So my dad was a very brave and strong man, but he was afraid to go to the hospital. But we, again, persuaded him to go. So that was the beginning of our nightmare.
And unfortunately, your father's prediction was right. He did not make it back. And this is the sort of thing that we've seen with this virus where, you know, you mentioned you have a big family. It ripped through your family. You got sick. Your mom got sick. Your brothers got sick. Do you know how the virus got in?
Yes. My brother that lives on the property, he's the sibling. We all have assigned responsibilities to help, you know, with my parents' home. My dad was very independent, as I said, but we tried to pitch in and help with my mom. My one brother takes care of all of her medical appointments, and she had an annual appointment. And my brother took her to that appointment. And when they got into the waiting room, there was no social distancing or spacing. And there were 3 patients that didn't have on masks. My brother says one of the biggest regrets of his life is that he just didn't say to Mom, come on, we're going to leave. Wow. But he didn't. Who would have guessed that this would have happened?
Well, and thank God your mom made it through. But how is she coping with all of this? She has dementia. Does she know what's going on?
That's a good question. You know, out of all of us that had COVID, she is the most unhealthy, and she survived it, which we are so grateful for. With her dementia, she doesn't tend to get emotionally responsive when we say he passed. She may say something like, well, when is Jesus going to come take me back to be with your dad?
How are you doing?
It is so difficult. You know, what I present is not what I'm feeling inside. It's so hard. I've been helped a great deal, as has the other members of my family, by some Facebook COVID support groups we've joined. The one that I participate in most is called COVID-19 Loss and Support for Family and Friends. And the biggest majority of us didn't really get to say goodbye to our loved one. We didn't get to support them, hover over them, nurture them. And that is just really, really hard to live with.
It is horrible. And you do sound strong, and you know you don't have to be. I hate to ask you this next question. I truly do, because this is your father's life that we're talking about, but there are so many other people who died in this country of COVID-19. And this election that's happening right now, where it's sort of a referendum on where we are as a country, who will lead us in the response to this pandemic, is however long it lasts. What's your reaction to the way President Trump has handled this?
Well, fortunately, you have just moved me from a point of tears to a point of anger. So thank you for that, Peter. And I guess this is a safe format to say this, that I think Mr. Trump is responsible for the great losses that we have suffered. He is our commander-in-chief, and he has not only grossly failed to step up and put practices and policies in place to protect us from COVID. He's done just the opposite. He minimizes COVID. He discounts COVID. And so consequently, we have this huge number of people that admire him, worship him, and they follow his recommendations. I won't call him president. I never have. I could say that he murdered my dad, or he contributed in killing my father and the other 220,000 precious lives that have been lost. We have a leader who influences so many people, and you just start to feel hopeless and feel despaired about it.
Well, Denise, I know you're not running away from those emotions. In fact, you almost literally wear them on your sleeve. I've seen a picture of you wearing a mask that says,
yes,
my father died of COVID-19, which is quite a message to receive at the grocery store and quite the message to send to people. So you're not running away from this.
Thank you. We are trying to increase people's awareness. You know, I told my kids, my siblings, that all change begins with one small action. So I wrote a petition and put it on change.org. The second step is the face mask. We're going to start wearing them probably by Friday, tomorrow, Saturday. And so the intention is that, you know, to the rest of the world that haven't experienced this, I want people to see my dad was not a number. He's not an abstract concept. He's not a nobody. This was a man who was a father that had a life, that was an important human being. And COVID took that from him and from us.
And his name was Everett Pike. Denise
yes,
Price.
Yes, and we called him Boone. Mm-hmm.
Denise Price is the daughter, a COVID survivor, who knows the pain of this disease firsthand. Thank you so much for your time, and we wish you peace.
Thank you, Peter.
There's a World Series going on. It's tied at one win apiece after Tampa Bay beat Los Angeles 6-4 last night. The Rays and Dodgers play Game 3 tomorrow night. The World Series is being played not in either team's ballpark, but in Arlington, Texas, home to the Texas Rangers. And a few fans are being allowed in. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, the Rays and Dodgers have tons of fans, but for others saying, I just can't. There's too much going on. Not a lot of fans there. Is it worth tuning in?
I think it's been a good series. And in the last couple of weeks, okay, it's subjective, but to me, the baseball postseason has really kicked in and has become meaningful and has started to bear some resemblance to the baseball that we know. But the thing to me is, the important thing is that the season was so shortened and we got weird results and we got teams with losing records in, say, the Houston Astros one game from the World Series. And so that's odd. But now you have the Dodgers, which really are the best team in baseball, and you have the Rays, which are a very good team and very much the kind of team who could have made the World Series in a regular season, and they're playing seven games, and the rules seem the same, and the stakes seem the same, and the emotions are high, and sometimes the high-fiving goes on so strongly that there are minor injuries, and it's replaced with a foot high-five, which actually happened in the case of Dodgers hitter. So yeah, there's a lot of fun going on in the World Series.
Okay, so again, Game 3 tomorrow night, but they didn't do a bubble as the NHL, NBA, WNBA did. So just talk about in general, I mean, this pandemic is going to go on for a while. How is sports faring?
Fair is the answer. And very much like society, or the portions of society that have a lot of resources, but not infinite resources, which is to say all of us, the teams, the smaller teams, the teams with smaller rosters like basketball were able to do it. But also the head of the NBA was very committed to doing a bubble, and it worked. It worked really well. It worked better, I think, than anyone could have imagined. And I don't think the football and baseball bubbles are, or sorry, lack of bubbles, the way they're conducting their sports, are falling apart. It's just very hard, as we all know. So let's take the NFL. There have been several teams with outbreaks, and so you have to rearrange the schedule. And right now, one analogy I heard to what the situation the NFL is in is a home that's mortgaged to the hilt. They have changed their schedule so much that there is almost no wiggle room left. And if there is another outbreak with another team or teams, the thinking is they might have to add a week to the season. They might have to push back the Super Bowl. But that's the situation we're in. And I don't know that anyone did anything wrong if you're not going to bubble. It's just that if you're going to be as careful as possible and do the right thing and shut down play if there are more than one or two positive cases, that's the reality.
Well, but and then let's talk about college football just real quick. But there's a lot of questions here because it's sort of bubble-ish. So you've got University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. They're requiring their undergrad students to stay at home for 2 weeks because of cases there. But athletes are exempt, and there's some football games coming up they're going to play. We know the Big Ten Conference begins its season. They weren't going to, and then they reversed course. President Trump is taking credit. But it just, how can they play football games when we know that cases are spiking on campuses and that's infecting and affecting the communities the colleges are in?
I think we just have to dispense with the fiction cognitively that these are college students who happen to play football. And everyone who knows it's big business, and not saying that the players don't have to go to class and in some cases aren't good students. But it really makes stark the fact that there are college students, there are college athletes, and then there are football players who happen to go to college. So when you look at the amount of money and also the amount of societal interest in the game of college football, there is so much more pressure on the teams to go out there and play for the glory of their school and also the glory of the green that a lot of different rules and different standards are being set with the football players than with the college students themselves.
Yeah. Well, University of Florida's football program shut down until at least next Monday because of an outbreak that includes their coach, Dan Mullen, who tested positive. I suppose it, you know, it just, it doesn't matter because you say the overriding interest is not just the money, but the people, they're demanding it. They're demanding the college games.
Yeah, and last week, two top five teams in the SEC, Alabama played Georgia. And if you didn't know anything else and didn't look too hard at the stands, it was this really good, entertaining college football game. So all the fans of those teams, maybe not Georgia as much as Alabama, would say, hey, it's working. Depends on what we define as working. Some version of college football is being played. An amount of entertainment is being delivered. But also there are great disruptions in the schedule just because college football is being played in America and we are experiencing what the experts are warning us might be a third surge.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.